Welcome to Almost Heretical. I'm Nate Hansen. Today, you're going to hear our really fascinating conversation with Thomas J. Ord. We talk about hell, we talk about the sadness of losing the afterlife in deconstruction, we talk about parapsychology and ghosts. This is something Thomas brings up like right at the end. He throws that in the last like 5-10 minutes about maybe we're all going to be ghosts, essentially. It's fascinating. This is the kind of stuff that I love talking about, and it's one of my favorite interviews we've ever done, so I'm glad you're here. Thomas J. Ord is a theologian, philosopher, professor at Northwest Nazarene University. He's known for his work on open and relational theology, which we get into a lot, especially at the beginning of this interview. And his latest book is God After Deconstruction. He wrote that with Trip Fuller. Go check it out, and there's a link to that in the show notes. If you finish this episode and want more, Shelby and I recorded an after show for this episode. I wanted to talk more about parapsychology and ghosts. Even after this episode, Shelby was feeling like, you know, what's the point of all this? What's the point of even calling this thing God? So we had a lot to unpack after talking with Thomas. And if you want to listen to that, you can click the link in the show notes or go to almostheretical.com. All right, here's our interview with Thomas J. Ord.
All right, Thomas, thank you so much for being here. I've heard your name through the grapevine for feels like years now, and so it's really wonderful to finally get to talk to you. I have not had the chance to actually read any of your books. I've just heard them recommended to me over and over again. So I'm hoping we can get kind of a bird's eye view of the amazing things that you have to share from what I've heard. So thanks for joining us.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to this conversation.
All right, so the main thing that I hear about when I hear about you is this open theism, open and relational theology. Can you tell us what that is? Sounds nice. The word open is always a good place to start, but I really have no idea what it means.
Well, let me start with relational. The idea in open and relational theology is that we live in an interrelated universe. We are relational beings, and probably most emphasized, God is relational. In other words, God not only influences us, but is influenced by us. And to most people I know who grow up in the church, that doesn't seem very controversial. I mean, if you read the Bible, it seems like the God described there is oftentimes happy, sad, whatever, engaged in the world in such a way that what we do actually has an impact upon God. But as you both know, the history of Christian and Islamic theology is a history in which the majority of the big thinkers, people like Martin Luther, John Calvin, Augustine, Aquinas, they did not think that God was relational in the sense that they did not think that what we do has an impact or influence on God. And the word they would use is impassible. Well, open relational theology thinks that God is relational. The open word has to do with the idea that we are moving through time into an open and yet to be determined future. And this is an open future even for God. So God doesn't sit outside time looking at all of history in one glance, not a timeless God. Rather, God experiences moment by moment, analogous to how we experience. And that means that God neither predestines everything to happen. In fact, God can't know with absolute certainty what's going to happen in the future. So to put it bluntly and probably a little bit provocatively, we just talk about the God of the Bible.
I thought you were going to say, to put it bluntly, John Piper's not a big fan of mine or something like that.
Well, that's true too.
Yeah, because you talk about, not that God hasn't predetermined everything. And I think like a lot of the problems that, because I was raised John Piper Baptist, basically, if that can be a denomination, that was what I was raised. The pinnacle was to be John Piper. And the idea was that God has predetermined everything, the good and the bad, right? So like, I know it sounds bad, but like there are people that God has before time, before they were born, predestined to go to hell. You know, like that was the belief that I remember defending that belief. I remember debating that belief. And now it just sounds so horrible to me. But yeah.
Yeah. I mean, to John Piper's credit, he often follows the logic of his assumptions. And one assumption is that God is omnipotent. Another assumption is that God is outside time. And so he has the balls to stand up there and say, whatever bad thing happened, well, that's what God wanted.
Yeah.
Now, most Christians I know, they think God is outside time. And they'll say, well, God doesn't predestine everything, but God is still omnipotent. But then when you start pressing them to sort of follow the logic of that kind of view of God, then they start playing the mystery card. They'll say, well, you know, God didn't want the Holocaust, but God allowed it.
Yeah.
And you're supposed to think, well, is that really loving to allow something horrible you could have stopped? And so even to John Piper's credit, he's consistent in a bad way, but other people are inconsistent and they still have what I think of as a bad theology.
Mm-hmm. All right. So going back to just still wrapping my head around what this open relational theology is all about.
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm getting that. It's, you know, God is experiencing with things with us moment by moment. Things are not fully predetermined. What do you think is the most beautiful part of relational theology? Like, why would you want to, you know, sell this to someone? I mean, not that it's something you're selling, but just, you know, as opposed to the traditional views of God, why do you feel like this is a more beautiful way to live and believe?
Well, let me tell you two things. First of all, I'm in the open relational game because I think it provides the best framework possible to talk about a God who's truly loving. Mm-hmm. And wants us to love too, because the God of conventional theologies doesn't come across as very loving by either causing or allowing horrific things to happen, by being outside of time and non-relational, for being primarily self-interested. I could go on and on about how I think the traditional God just doesn't come across as loving as we understand loving. But secondly, if God is affected by us and the future is open, that means our lives and our decisions actually matter. The future is going to be partly shaped by what you and I do. And I think that means that life is actually significant, meaningful. What we do count. And a lot of people find that very attractive.
Yeah. And very significant.
Yeah.
I often refer to the inner apologist that's in my mind from my growing up days in my conservative fundamentalist homeschooled apologetics background.
Yep.
So sometimes I like to ask those questions because I think also a lot of listeners are probably either maybe they're still feeling some of those things themselves of like, what about this? What about that? Or they are sure that they have friends and family that would push back in certain ways.
Yes.
So for those reasons, I'm going to ask you a few questions that don't really concern me at this point, but I think maybe for other people.
Okay.
Yeah. Where do you get the basis for the relational theology? Is it the Bible or is it something else?
Yeah, I think the majority of scripture points to an open and relational God, but I wouldn't say absolutely every verse in the Bible does. So, and I'm fine with that. Some people want a totally infallible, inerrant, totally internally consistent and coherent Bible, but that just doesn't seem to be the Bible we actually have. Yeah. I do think, however, the overall gist of Scripture points to a God of love and real giving and receiving relationships, who makes covenants with creatures and says things like, if my people who are called by my name will humble themselves, I will do X. If they don't, I will do Y. And it kind of sounds like God's decisions about what's going to happen is dependent upon what we do. And so that's a way that fits very nicely. But it's not just scripture, as important as that is to many open relational thinkers. It's also the fact that this way of thinking just fits the way we live our lives. Mm. It fits our experience of having partial freedom. You know, we make free choices, not unlimited freedom, but some freedom. We think that what we do counts. We think the values and the intuitions we have about love are important. And so a lot of times I'll present this picture to an audience and people will come up to me afterwards and they'll say, you know, I've kind of already been believing like this. I just didn't have the words because this just matches my intuitions.
That's really beautiful. And I think the matching our intuitions is, it's kind of a skill that you have to learn to trust. You know, a lot of us, I think, growing up would, you know, the fact that you have an intuition about what you would hope God is like doesn't really mean anything. You know, you read the Bible and that's what God is. But to be able to somewhat shape our view of God based on what we believe is good and right. I mean, even as I say that, I still get struck with like, okay, but are we just making the God that we want? And are we just forming it right. subjectively?
And it's a fair question to ask, are you making God in your own image or whatever image you have? But what most people who ask it don't realize is that question applies to everybody, not just the positions they don't like. Yeah.
Hey, Brian, do you know anyone that was once a teenage fundamentalist?
Oh, Troy, you know that I was because you and I have a podcast called I Was a Teenage Fundamentalist.
I did know that. But you know what I find myself asking these days?
No, I don't, but I think you're going to tell me.
What about all those things that church gave us definite answers for? What are we supposed to think about all those things now?
Well, funnily enough, that's what we're doing for season 5 of I Was a Teenage Fundamentalist.
Ooh, Brian. I sense the Lord at work here.
He works in mysterious ways. And we are going to unpack these things. We're going to find out what we do think about them now.
So tune in to season 5 of I Was a Teenage Fundamentalist, the official podcast for the Azusa Street Revival.
I'm not quite sure that's true, but it is available wherever you get your podcasts.
But I think it's even worse than, you know, you saying you grow up and you ask the question, does this match the God of the Bible when it comes to intuitions? I think it's also the case that people are told, and I'm guessing you guys were also told this, that you're fallen creatures. You're depraved. You can't trust your intuitions. In fact, the heart is evil above all things. And that then sets you up to have to trust something outside of yourself. And you know, you're very susceptible then to be the pawns of power-hungry leaders or particular interpretations of the Bible. So open and relational theology is also undermining that view that people are just crap and totally worthless and can't trust any feelings they have.
Yeah, I will say the idea of viewing God, it's almost making God less like this almighty father kind of picture. So then how do you keep it from going from this, you know, omnipotent, almighty, unchanging father kind of figure to not turning into some kind of pan like, you know, deity who's just kind of does whatever's up to their own whims? Like, where's the basis of a God that you can still trust, even if it's a God who can change?
Yes. Oh, man, I love that question. So I'm going to get nerdy just for a second here.
All right, go for it.
Most open and relational thinkers believe God's essence or nature is unchanging, but God's experience changes in giving and receiving love relationships. So I call this God's essence experience binate. There's two parts of God, God's nature and God's experience. So because God's nature of love or essence is immutable and never changes, we can count on God never to break bad, never to go evil, never to go rogue in an insidious way. However, because God's experience is giving and receiving love, God's going to respond and act in a loving way tailor-made to the individual and situation. So God's flexible in that sense. And that overcomes in the legitimate worry you raise about, you know, well, how do you trust God then? Well, we can trust God because God's nature is unchanging love, and God's giving and receiving experience of love is adjusts and mutates, you might say, moment by moment in relationship.
This leads right into a question that, interestingly enough, has come up in several of our latest interviews, all unplanned, which is, so if you're talking about a God who's, you know, all love, and I think you use the term uncontrolling love in some of your posts and such, which goes back, the first time this came up was a couple interviews ago, our interview with David Fitch, who's talking about God's love being non-coercive, and so we were asking him about, you know, what about beliefs, if you believe in hell or really any kind of judgment, even if it's annihilation or something like that, then how can that possibly be non-coercive? So I'll point the question to you of what do you are you a universalist? What do you believe happens to people when they die? Does anything, do you discern, like how is God's love uncontrolling in that sense?
If the three major views of the afterlife are the traditional heaven-hell view, annihilationism, or sometimes called conditional immortality, and universalism, I'm none of the three.
Okay. Getting exciting.
I got my fourth view. First, of course, I don't believe in hell in the sense of eternal conscious torment. I don't think a loving God would send people there. So I'm guessing a lot of folks who listen to this also are dissatisfied with
that
view.
Yes, have for the most part. And we've talked about on some of our past series about how, like, the Bible doesn't even really support the idea of hell, and definitely doesn't make it an essential belief.
Right, right. So the annihilationists have an advantage in that they don't have eternal conscious torment, but they still have a God who seems to decide some people aren't worth continuing to keep existing in the afterlife.
Which is really horrible.
Right, yeah. God either annihilates them actively or at least passively by not resurrecting them. Yeah. And to me, that's not steadfast love. So I don't like that.
Especially if it's based on assenting to a certain belief.
Right.
Which is what most people would say that it is.
Yeah. Now, so that makes universalism attractive to many people. But as I think you're implying in your question, most people would think that universalism requires a God with controlling power to make sure everybody gets to the good place, mm-hmm. whatever that looks like. And I don't believe God has that kind of power. So my view is that God, moment by moment, invites us to a relationship of love in this life and the next. And God never, ever gives up on anybody or anything capable of that kind of a choice. And that extends beyond humans in my mind. And that means that if we cooperate with God, we enjoy the positive benefits that come from living a life of love. If we choose not to cooperate in any particular moment, God doesn't punish us, but there are natural negative consequences to choosing something other than love. That's just the way things are in the world. But God never gives up. So in my scheme, there's no guarantee that everyone will eventually say yes to God, because that guarantee could only come if there was a God with controlling power. But there's the real hope that because God never gives up on anybody, and there's never a time limit to this relationship, that eventually everyone and everything who's capable of responding will say yes to God. Just to give you a label, I call this the relentless love view of the afterlife.
Mm. there's a song that came out in the peak of my Christian days, which wasn't that long ago, called Relentless Love. We sing that song over and over again. Not sure if the theology would hold up, but you just brought it back to mind. But does the God that you're, you know, referring to, knowing in relationship with, is it a Christian God? Or can it be, like, is this also, like, would you say that someone in Islam who is, you know, in relationship with God, is that the same God that they're in relationship with? Or Hinduism? Or, how do you... Yeah. Who is God?
There are Muslim open and relational thinkers, Baha'i, many Jewish open and relational thinkers, some who don't identify with any religious tradition, Hindu. Just last week, a book came out that I was a co-editor of that is a conversation between Muslims and Christians who are all open and relational thinkers about how this view of God affects social and political issues. So, no, this God isn't confined to Christianity. I happen to be a Christian because I'm really attracted to this Jesus guy, and because I like at least some parts of the tradition. Other parts I think suck, but I'm really attracted to this Jesus guy. But you don't have to be a Christian to be an open and relational thinker.
Well, that is great news, I think, for a lot of people. And I also feel that way of, well, let's see, who is it? Barbara Brown Taylor talked about how she's a Christian almost in the same, because Christianity is her first language, I think is the language she used. Not that that has to be the one and only way, but it's the only way for her because it's, you know, she'll never have another first language like she has in Christianity, but that someone else very much could have theirs in another religion. So that sounds like a similar point of view.
It is very similar. And I find, and I'm guessing some of the people listening to the show might fit here, I find lots of people who grew up in the Christian tradition got so dissatisfied with it, they walked away, but they still believe in an open and relational God. So they didn't like switch to another religion. They kind of consider themselves non-religious or spiritual, but not religious, or, you know, one of those kind of labels. But they still believe in a God who's open and relational.
All right. So you use this term uncontrolling God, which is just a wonderful mindset, I think, to have. But can you elaborate a little bit more on like what that means? Just because it seems like it's come up in a lot of our interviews lately.
Yeah, it's a huge category for me. I find most people will say God doesn't control everything. Like they're not hardcore Calvinists who are theological determinists who just say, you know, God controls everything. But a lot of people still think God could control from time to time and does. And so they'll say, well, miracles happen when God steps in, intervenes, and controls a situation to bring about some good result. Of course, the problem with that view is that if God can do it sometimes, then you're wondering why God doesn't do it more often to stop horrific things in our individual lives and in, you know, our society.
Yeah, like does God really have power to
right.
And yeah, if so, why wouldn't?
Yeah, if God does a miracle here by controlling, why doesn't God do a miracle to prevent my sister's rape? You know, why doesn't, whatever. So that control issue is a real problem. But a lot of Christians, at least, and Muslims and Jews, but we'll talk about Christians here, they think they have to be committed to a God who is omnipotent or all-powerful or almighty, whichever, sovereign, whichever word you like. And they think that because they think the God of the Bible is that. And in fact, the word, most English translations don't have the word omnipotent in it, but it does have the word almighty. And when we look at the Hebrew scriptures, the words almighty come from two Hebrew words, one Shaddai. So some of your folks may have heard the phrase El Shaddai.
Oh, yeah.
And the other is Sabaoth. Well, Shaddai means something like breasts, like the nourishing breasts of God, or mountains. And Sabaoth means something like a leader of hosts. So sometimes in the Hebrew scriptures or the English translations, you'll get Lord of hosts.
Yeah.
But neither of those mean omnipotent or almighty or all-powerful or controlling. But what happened is in the Septuagint, so the Greek Jews in the 2nd and 3rd century BCE, when they translate the Hebrew into Greek, they chose the word pantocrator. Panto meaning all, crater something like holding. So God moved from the nourishing breast and the leader of hosts to the all-holding one, which is still not all-controlling. But then in the New Testament, we find that word pantocrator 10 times, only 10 times, 9 of them in Revelation.
Wow.
And none of them have to be translated as omnipotent. But again, English translations usually use the word almighty. And the reason they do that is because Jerome, one of the major translators of scripture into Latin, chose the word omnipotent, or in Latin, it's omnipotence. So that's why in the creeds, like we have, we believe in God the Father Almighty, in the Latin, that's omnipotent. Mm. And that's a translation of pantocrator, which is a mistranslation of the Hebrews. So,
oh, man.
Yeah. Oh. So what we've got is a wild scenario here.
Wow. Man, I love hearing like how translations have gotten off over the years, but I've never heard that one. That's pretty crazy. Yeah. And the fact that it's literally in the creeds that's a huge
yes,
one.
Yes, it's in the creeds. Yes. Yeah.
Well, and what's crazy to me is people will hold so tightly to a specific word, right? Like this was a lot of my, the way I used to teach the Bible and the communities I was a part of, it was like, do you notice that in this verse, God uses the word da da da, you know? And it's like, or the creed, we say this. It's like, you got to look at the history of like, how did we even get here? And maybe let's not hold so tightly to this specific word. And let's look at the general ideas of what's going on in these different passages.
Yeah, and at the very least, go to the original language. But then even the original languages, there's a story of how it got there. And yeah, maybe the authors weren't as fixated with every single word as we often are today.
Yeah, yeah. And if listeners want to sort of see the scholarly details behind all of this, I wrote a book published last year called The Death of Omnipotence and Birth of Amipotence. Mm-hmm. And there's one really big chapter on the Bible and this story that I'm telling you right now with gazillion footnotes. If you know Hebrew, you'll like that stuff.
So what is amipotence?
Aha. So since I don't think God can control, and I think omnipotence is a dead end,
do you think God can't, just clarifying, is it that God can't control or God does not control?
Great clarification. God simply can't.
Okay.
It's impossible for God. Why? Because God's love comes first in God, and I think God's love is inherently or necessarily uncontrolling. So if love is by nature uncontrolling and God is by nature love, then God can't control. Yeah. So anyway, I wrote a book actually with the title God Can't. And
You. Okay. I was going to say, I've heard of a book out there called God Can't.
Yeah. And people who read it, I got really lots of great notes from people who have been abused and harmed and asking questions. But I realized that people didn't easily see a constructive alternative. So I invented the word amipotence, ami meaning love, potence meaning power, to say that God is powerful, but God's power is the power of uncontrolling love. And that's what the second part of that title is about.
I would love to hear about this new book that you've written, are writing with Trip Fuller, about deconstruction, because it's just such a, it's called God After Deconstruction, right?
Yeah, yep.
This is, and I saw on your site, last month, you reviewed Alyssa Childers' book, The Deconstruction of Christianity, which is, very hot topic. It's just such a polarizing topic right now. I feel like there's been a wild west of, shows like ours and others who were able to like kind of run free with the term deconstruction for years. And then as the more conservative church like gets a hold of, they're like, wait a minute, we need to kind of have an answer
control
here. We need
us.
To have a response. We got to control it, right?
Yeah.
That's what the Gospel Coalition does. That's what Desiring God does, is they write their review. They squash something down, right?
Yeah.
And so you see like Josh Butler's post about like the reasons why people are deconstructing, and like a lot of our listeners are going like, that doesn't describe me at all, right?
Yeah.
And like you have Alyssa Childers writing this book, and I've thumbed through it, and it's like, that doesn't describe me or our listeners really at all.
Yeah.
I don't know. Why did you feel like you needed to write a book about deconstruction? And yeah, maybe we can get to Alyssa's book later here.
Yeah, well, we take deconstruction seriously and think it's legitimate. My co-author Trip Fuller and I have been through our own deconstructive processes and still go through it in some sense. And so we think that deconstruction is a reality, and it's painful for many people. And then once they sort of set aside the crap that they used to believe, the views of God that we think are harmful, the practices, once they walk away from harmful communities, then everyone says, okay, what now? How do we live? How do we think? And what we wanted to propose is this open and relational vision that I've sketched out already as a way to think about God that makes sense of your lives, that rejects all the crap that you should rightly reject that you were taught in the past or, you know, learned through culture or whatever, and it presents a beautiful picture of a loving God and takes your experience seriously. And so, you know, after we kind of talk about what deconstruction is in the book, we look at 9 reasons people legitimately deconstruct. We affirm those reasons, and then we say things, you know, basically we say, but here's a way to think about God in light of this. So, yes. You know, take, for example, sexuality issues. Yeah, the church has been wrong about queer issues. The church has been wrong to put women in a particular place. Complementarianism is wrong. Yeah, purity culture hurts us. It sucks. We should reject all of that. Here, however, is a better way to think that's queer affirming, that's women affirming, that doesn't think purity culture is the answer to how we think about our passions, pleasures, urges, etc. So each chapter kind of presents the problem, the real issue that we should take seriously, and then an open relational response.
Yeah, I love that. I mean, much more than a lot of the stuff I see out there, which in children's books seems similar. Do you know the Joshua Butler post? I think it was on.
You know, I don't remember reading it, but I know of it vaguely. You know,
right? Yeah, right. Yeah, I think the reasons given. I mean, I remember one of them being like people deconstruct for street cred.
Yeah,
because they want to sin.
I've heard that.
Bad,
one.
What were the other ones? Bad teaching, I think. Bad.
Yeah, they just need better teaching, right?
Yeah.
There's one more. I can't remember what it was.
Right. But like, I love what you're saying. You know, maybe you are actually, let's look at that, like bad teaching, right? So maybe you are kind of honing in on that one a little bit from Butler's post. Maybe there is something there you're saying. Maybe there is some bad teaching we've had or believed or discovered in culture or whatever. Would that be accurate?
Yeah, but I'm guessing the teaching that I'm going to propose is pretty different from his, you know. If he's anything like Lisa and Tim in their Deconstruction of Christianity book, what they're doing is they're saying, look, we've got to stick to the Bible. We've got this objective standard, and deconstruction is all about moving away from that standard and trusting your own subjective experiences and beliefs. But, you know, we've got the objective thing. It doesn't even need to be interpretive. It's just there.
Yeah.
And I just don't think that works. And most people who deconstruct would agree with me.
How would you respond to them saying exactly that, of deconstruction is all about just moving away from through? We kind of mentioned this earlier, but your subjective experience and having yourself as the authority. That was a big thing for me. People confronted me about when I first started deconstructing who's the authority in your life now? What's the authority in your life if it's not the Bible?
Well, what Tim and Elisa do is they set you up to make an either-or choice. They say, look, you either trust yourself and your own experiences, or you trust the Bible, which is outside of yourself. But that's the wrong choice, because we all read the Bible through our experiences. So it's not like no one, you know, everyone comes to the Bible with a particular perspective, life experiences. So, you know, there's no objective truth that gets unfiltered. We're all filtering it through who we are. But on the other hand, our individual experiences are always influenced by what's around us, what we read, our culture, our life experiences. So there's no pure subjective experience that hasn't been influenced by what's outside of you. So what we need to do is think about our experience and how we discern all of these sources of possible truth and helpfulness in our world, the Bible being one, but not the only one of them. And so I think a more realistic, to use the fancy word, the more realistic epistemology is to say, yes, we start with our experience, but our experience has already been influenced by all kinds of things. And then we have to move step by step, trying to make sense of the world. By the way, just if people really care about lots of the details, I've got a big long blog review of that book, so you can go to my blog and pick that up.
Yeah, that's what I was looking at here, and we'll link to it in the show notes, but go for it, Shelby.
How would you differentiate God from the Force in Star Wars? In what ways is it the same, and in what ways is it different?
I love it. This, like, it's almost
Shelby's always going to get to Star Wars somehow. So
really,
I've spent too many episodes lately where I have not referenced Star Wars. So we're bringing it back.
Well, that's wild because you haven't read my material, and I'll bet I've talked about the Force in three or four books.
Well, I mean, I think it's fascinatingly profound.
Yes.
And I mean, it's no surprise because it does stem from, you know, Taoism type. Like, it's not, it's just pulled out of nowhere.
But actually, I criticize it. So,
Well, no, it's okay. That's okay. Why I asked the question. I mean, the Force is not very relational. So I imagine
that's exactly my criticism. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I believe in a relational God. I like to say God is a universal spirit of relational love. And I like to contrast that from the impersonal force of Star Wars, which is kind of like gravity. You know, it's like a force in the world, but it's no giving and receiving. It doesn't even seem to be intentional or personal. But then I also want to contrast it to what I think a lot of people image God as, kind of like the old guy up in the sky with a particular body, or even a better analogy, Sasquatch. I live up here in the Northwest, and
So do we.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So people talk about,
hey, Sasquatch is real. Okay. And I'll end this interview right now.
I might not believe in much, but I believe in Sasquatch.
Exactly.
So, you know, Sasquatch is supposedly an individual being roaming around the Cascade Mountains, and people claim to see this being every once in a while. So it's there and makes very rare appearances, which sounds kind of like the God many people believe in, like an individual somewhere who are very occasionally, you know, will come out and nobody ever, you know, gets a picture on the iPhone, but still it's this God is out there. I don't believe in that God either, because I think God is truly universal, truly present to everyone at all times. In fact, God doesn't have a localized body. God is a universal spirit. So I'm trying to point out a view of God that's between an impersonal force like Star Wars and a localized body like Sasquatch.
Best of both worlds.
Yeah. And then keep the personal side of Sasquatch and the omnipresence of the Force.
If we had as much video footage of God as we have of Sasquatch, I don't think anyone would be deconstructing. But
actually, you know, this is a side thing, but I just heard a really good argument the other day for the non-existence of Sasquatch. And the argument was this. The number of iPhones in the world is totally gone up, but the number of images of Sasquatch have not. So
it's for all of us believers out there, it is a tough one to wrestle with, Thomas, I'll be honest. Okay. So this all sounds good to me, right? Like relational God. I want to get like to a personal level though.
Good.
Like with you, Thomas, have you experienced God relationally, you know, or is this just a better version of God to believe in? Because my experience before, I felt like everyone was having a better spiritual experience than I was. This is like back in the day when I was more conservative, but I felt like everyone was having this spiritual experience, this relationship with God, hearing from God, and I never really was. And that's not the nature of my deconstruction. That's not like the genesis of it, but it is something I look back on and go like, that wasn't present there. So it was more like a belief system. Like I believed these things. So I guess I want to ask you, this does sound like a better version of God. I remember the first time I read Lies We Believe About God by
Paul Young.
Paul Young, there we go. Yep. Another Oregonian here.
That's right.
But I remember crying and being like, man, I wish I had had this version of God. And so I feel that when I'm hearing you talk about this open and relational God. Mm. But have you experienced that God? Do you experience that God?
Yes, I think I experienced that God moment by moment. But let me talk about what that experience is not. So like you, I've heard people talk about their experience of God, and I've assumed that God must periodically intervene in our lives and have some kind of overwhelming, overpowering experience such that in this moment, we can be 100% sure it was God who did something or made us feel a particular way or something happened. That was a God moment, we might say. Yeah. I don't believe that that's possible. I do, however, think that God is moment by moment interacting with us. And there may be some peak moments, there may be some dramatic feelings, et cetera, in which we are cooperating well with God, or the conditions are right, or, you know, it's really late night on a weekend with the youth group and you're just really tired and you're maybe, you know, just more vulnerable. Or maybe sometimes you're just more attuned to God because you've been meditating, or you're like me and you like to hike a lot and you're out in the wilderness, and every once in a while you just have this like overwhelming feeling of warmth and beauty. So yeah, I think I experience God every single moment, but there are some times when those moments seem more rich, more full in some kind of way. Not because God does more at those times, but because maybe I'm attuned to God, or the conditions are conducive for that.
So it's like we've been calling the wrong things God, and we haven't been calling other things that probably are God, God.
Yeah, yeah. I have a friend who who says she's never experienced God, and she's always wanted to. And I asked her about giving birth to her child. She said that was like one of the most loving and beautiful experiences. And I said, well, to me, God is the source of all that's good and loving. And in that particular moment, I think you were experiencing God, not just God. You're experiencing other forces and factors as well. But there's no reason to sort of just think God has to be those one particular time in which you have to discount any other natural cause or action, and it's got to only be God. I just don't believe that happens.
Yeah. Okay, pause the interview real quick. It's Nate jumping in after the fact to say, if you're enjoying this conversation with Thomas J. Ord, Shelby and I recorded an after show. We do this for a lot of our episodes. It's called Utterly Heretical. It's an after show that you can get by clicking the link in the show notes below. We'd love to see you there. It's an extra 15 to 20 minutes talking about some of the topics that you heard in this interview. We debrief the episode. We share what we really thought about certain things, and it's unedited and pretty fun. So we'd love to see you there. Click the link in the show notes now. All right, back to the interview.
I think when I first started deconstructing, and prayer was a huge part of my life before, and I think because of how huge it was for me, it was also one of the first things to go. And I mean, my story, essentially there was just a tragedy of multiple friends died in a car accident, and it just, I was just like, I can't pray anymore.
Yeah.
It just, it didn't work. And I kind of felt guilty about that, because I knew that there were probably people who were saying, well, you know, that's just your trauma, or your whatever, you know, that don't put that on God. But if, I was like, well, I just can't, I can't. And then, so, you know, and then I started also deconstructing just through biblical studies, through a lot of other forms. So it wasn't just that one emotional piece. Mm-hmm. And I got to the point where I was really, like, I did not feel like I was having any relationship with God whatsoever. I'm felt like functionally an atheist, even though, you know, I fully believed like there's no way to know either way, would never have claimed to be an atheist. But in that, I still, like, there were still a lot of moments where I would feel or hear a voice inside me that in the past I would have attributed to God. I would have said was the Holy Spirit, you know, that still small voice that my mom taught me about. And I just started to, I started to become comfortable with the idea that maybe that voice that I've been listening for all along, thinking was God, maybe that's just me. And has always just been part of me. So with that, like, that was kind of my story. And I think from what you're saying, you would say, well, that voice, like, that has been God all along. It's just a different God. And I guess the question that I'm trying to get at is, if you were to suddenly know, which obviously you cannot know, but if you were to suddenly know that there is not actually a God, like, not actually any separate being, would that change your life, or would you do you think that your life would still kind of, like, how much of that relationalism is happening kind of inside us anyway, like with or without a God? I don't know if that question makes sense.
Yeah.
Or not.
Well, I do think we are relational with or without a God. So I believe in a relational universe. God for me functions in a number of ways. One of them is kind of an explanation for why there is so much beauty, love, purpose in the world. And so if you said there is no God, that would be a pretty big deal for me. I sometimes make big sacrifices in the name of love, believing that there is something like a God at work in the world who wants something, wants the world to be a better place, and my contribution, my sacrifice, can be part of that. If you told me there was no God, I might still sacrifice in some cases, but it would be harder for me. But I want to, if it's okay with you, I want to talk about prayer. Is that all right?
Yeah.
You know, of course, there are many kinds of prayer. Sometimes prayer is just sort of voicing your ideas or frustrations or whatever. But two kinds of prayers make more sense in an open relational prayer view. One is prayers of thanksgiving. Because in an open relational perspective, you don't have to say thank you, God, when something crappy happens. When, you know, like if you're a really a hardcore person who thinks that God is in control of everything, then everything bad that happens to you, God either caused or allowed it. And so you should say thank you to God for that. But I don't have to from an open and relational perspective, because I don't think God caused it or even allowed it, as if God could have stopped it. So every good thing that occurs, I thank God and I thank others in the universe who contributed with God to make that happen.
Yeah, I was going to say, so if you don't thank God for the bad things because God isn't controlling that, then like it seems a little like what's the it's a win-win for God here if, you know, God
it
gets
is.
To get thanked gets to be thanked for the good stuff. Well, then was God controlling the good stuff? Like is God
no,
controlling anything?
Not controlling anything, not the good stuff either, but was a cause in the good stuff along with other causes. So, you know, think about when you do something good for someone else, but you know you weren't the only cause to make it happen, then you deserve some thanks and praise, you know.
So God's just kind of like one of the people who
one of the causes.
Is involved.
That's right.
And you would
yes.
say, and the nature of that cause is, you said the source, use that word, the source.
Yeah.
So that's primarily the way that God would cause something is by being the one who started not even just that thing that happened, but like way back to the beginning, if we want to be bound by time or something, the beginning of anything good.
Yeah.
You're saying,
well, and I think God acts moment by moment. So the beginning would be in that particular moment.
Okay.
So God
okay.
would be a necessary cause that both empowers and inspires creatures to respond. And therefore when good happens, God gets partial credit, but not all the credit. It reminds me actually of it's been 30 years ago. I was at this church and the pastors were leaving the church and they were having a going away thing. And they had me come in to preach so that they, you know, the pastors didn't have to preach the last Sunday. And the people were talking about how God is in control of everything. We don't have to worry here because God is the one who brought them here. God is the one who directed everything. And then they had a big thank you. And so they showered them the gifts and expressed thanks. And I thought, well, look, if your theology is that God does absolutely everything, then you shouldn't thank the pastors. They're just robots, basically. You know, they're just
right.
doing what they're pre-programmed to do. But if you really do thank them, you must think that they have some role in cooperating with God or not. And therefore, God's only one cause among others. And that makes a lot more sense to me.
Mm.
But I want to talk about petitionary prayer, because I think that's the one that most people wonder about when it comes to open and relational theology. I want to go through four models of prayer. The fourth one will be the one I like.
Okay.
So petitionary would be like, I mentioned to a coworker that like, hey, you know, our new baby is having trouble sleeping. They're like, hey, I'll be praying about that. I'll be praying
yes.
for you.
Or my aunt's got cancer, so I pray to God and ask God to heal my aunt. Something
right.
like that. Yeah. It's a form of prayer that most people, I think, engage in. It's definitely biblical. So what's going on there? Well, if you're a hardcore Calvinist who think God predetermined everything from all eternity, I think you'd have a hard time really getting motivated to pray a petitionary prayer because
yeah.
the future has already been decided. It doesn't matter a whit what you decide to do because God's mm-hmm. already determined it, right? So that's pretty easy. Even though most Calvinists who are my friends actually do pray, they do out of obedience to God rather than
right.
out of any...
They would do it more because they believe God wants them to
yes,
pray.
Yes, yeah. So they kind of check their brain in at the door on this issue and pray anyway. More common, and especially in the circles I grew up in, was this view. God's omnipotent. God asked us to ask God, so we're supposed to petition God. God could up and fix anything at any time for any reason, because God can just do whatever God wants to do. God is smarter than you and me, in fact, omniscient. God is loving, in fact, all loving. But the problem with that view is that you think that a God who is can do anything at any time and is loving and smart doesn't really need our prayers. In fact, if we pray and ask God to do something wrong, then God wouldn't do it because God is loving. In fact, what makes it worse is that sometimes this God is portrayed as kind of sitting back, arms folded, looking at us saying, you know, I'm not going to get off my butt unless you ask me. Unless you put it on the prayer chain at church and you pray 37 times, I could do it at any time if I wanted to, but I'm not going to do it until you ask, which does not sound like a loving person to me. Right. I mean, can you imagine if you're one of your child who's sick today is out in swimming in one of the lakes in Oregon, and you look up and is it he or is she?
She
start to drown, but she doesn't call out for help. Are you going to sit on the side and say, well, you know, she's not asking me to help here, so I'm not going to help, you know? No, you're going to jump right in. But that's the God lots and lots of people believe in, an omnipotent, loving, all-knowing God who still sits back and just won't act, sometimes at least, until we pray. That makes no sense to me. So, third model. This is more, I hear this one in more progressive circles. They say this, prayer doesn't change God, it changes me.
It changes you.
Yeah. Now, there's a partial truth there in there, because I think, yes, prayer can have a real effect on our lives, but it portrays God like the force, right? It portrays God as impersonal.
It's basically the Calvinist view again.
It is. Yeah, it sounds like that. So here's the model from an open relational perspective that I think makes a lot more sense. It says this, God also moves through time moment by moment. And when we act, and prayers are actions, those actions have an effect upon us, upon God, and upon the world. And God takes into God's experience moment by moment everything that happens, including our prayers. And because we act in particular ways, new possibilities, new opportunities for God to act in the next moment become possible. It doesn't mean that our prayers somehow turbocharge God to control some situation, because I don't believe in a controlling God. But because God is really relational, God takes in a kind of relational information into God's experience and then can use that such that the future just might be different because of the way we acted.
It feels to me, just thinking about this kind of new version of God, it feels more like a friend than more like a friend than a, can't think of a better word than God, really. Because I'm so used to thinking of God. A king, or even like a father or a protector, because I guess when you take out that control, like that's probably where we found a lot of the safety in believing about God, is in believing that God can control certain circumstances. So when you take that out, you know, my inner gut feeling from putting myself back in those evangelical shoes is like, well, what's the point of that God? You know, if that God can't, which I realize is a, you know, fairly selfish question to ask of, like, if this God can't do anything, then what's the point? But it does feel like this God is more of just a companion.
Yes, a friend, companion. This God is doing things, just not controlling. And there's a big difference. But yeah, I get the same kind of thing. People will say to me, well, I want a God who can control. That way God can rescue me from things go bad. And I say to that person, well, how's that working out for you? Because look, bad things happen. And then God didn't stop them. So maybe you ought to give up on that idea, but you don't have to give up on believing in God. There is a friend, an omnipresent universal spirit who's a friend.
I think it's maybe less about like wanting, there is definitely that like wanting God to step in and stop something bad from happening, but there's also just this like pleasant feeling of like, even if bad things happen in my life, and this was a big belief for me, even if bad things happen in my life, there's a greater purpose that I just might not understand, right? And I might not understand until I'm gone, until everyone I know is gone. I mean, it's pretty convenient to be able to say that, right? To be able to say like, yeah, you're just not going to get it and no one's going to get it. And it's like, okay, well, that doesn't really help either. But anyways, I think that maybe is part of it too. What feels good about that belief is that it's connected to some, you know, that baby may have died, but it's connected to some big purpose that I just can't see yet or something like that.
It's the mystery card. And
right.
You know, some people go their whole lives playing that mystery card. It doesn't work for me. But what I find often happens is people play the mystery card until something really atrocious happens. And then they just can no longer say, well, it must be a part of God's inscrutable plan. And then they start deconstructing.
Right. Except John Piper has found a way.
Yeah. But he's one of the ones who can do it his whole life.
Isn't there like the tornado that hit the church in Minneapolis or in Minnesota? And he's like, that was because they were meeting about being affirming of homosexuality, I believe, is what he said in
is
the
that
tweet.
Right?
Anyways, okay. So as we sort of wrap up here, I'm curious. I like to ask guests this sometimes, especially if they have kind of the theological background. It's not just the faith background of let's talk about how this all feels, but let's talk about like the nitty gritty here. I want to ask you, what's the most heretical thing you believe? And I'd say, let's define this by what would keep you from being able to preach in the most amount of churches. That most amount of churches would be like, nah, we're not going to have Ord on because, you know, he
believes
thinks,
this.
Da, da, da.
Yeah, well, that's actually happened to me many times. So
I'm sure it has.
Yeah. Well, not believing in hell is important for some people. Not believing God is omnipotent. I don't think God knows the future. I don't think God only loves Christians or only Christians go to heaven or can find salvation. Yeah, it's hard because what some people think must be orthodox is not only not well biblically supported, but not even necessarily in the creeds.
Mm-hmm.
So what people
call hell's not in the original creeds.
Yeah, yeah. So what people call heresy these days, it rarely fits anything like what the early church would have called heresy. But not that I'm trying to say all my views fit the early church, but because, you know, my view that God doesn't know the future, probably very few people thought that.
Well, here's one that the early church probably would have called you heretic over that we didn't touch on. Maybe we can hit at the end here is Jesus. What do you believe about Jesus, he was?
Yeah, I would have been an Arian in the early church. So I would have been a person who thought Jesus was a human, but a special human because he responded to God's calling moment by moment. So I have what in the academy is called a spirit Christology, which means that I think Jesus responds to the Spirit in such a way that he reveals God's love better than any other. So we can call him divine, but if we do, we shouldn't think that he's omnipresent or omniscient or those kind of characteristics. We should say that he's the best expression of God's love, at least from a Christian perspective, I would say that.
Could there be a better one in the future?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's possibly, yeah, yeah. And of course, I never knew Jesus personally, so I don't. Right. Maybe he did sins.
Oh, and that was my next question would be, so then you would, this would probably be another thing that would keep you out of churches. You would say that nobody has a personal relationship with Jesus.
I wouldn't say nobody, but I would say very few people. If Jesus is still a localized spirit in the afterlife, he's at one place and one time. And so maybe Jesus is hanging out in Bermuda right now. But
are we all localized spirits in the afterlife? We
I
haven't
think
gone
so.
Here.
Yeah.
Wow, let's talk about this.
Yeah. I don't
this
know.
Interview is not over yet.
Yeah. I mean, I suspect that we don't become omnipresent. I mean, I don't know that you can have more than one omnipresent being.
So we don't become omnipresent, but we don't go away to some other place.
I think that we will continue to have subjective experiences beyond the death of our body. But the I that's Tom, the mind, you might say, or the soul, I like to use the word mind. The mind of Tom is probably in his brain right now, but I think it will continue to exist beyond bodily death. And that, I'm claiming, won't become omnipresent.
So essentially like a ghost. I mean, I don't mean that in some like weird way, but I mean, it sounds a localized spirit. That sounds like a fancy word for ghost.
Yeah. Yeah. Casper, the friendly ghost.
And I mean, it
doesn't sell as much localized spirit.
So, I mean, I don't mind that at all. Then do you,
I don't think it's unorthodox. I mean, there's lots of options on the table as I read the scriptures. So
does that affect how you go about life? Like, do you feel like your loved ones are around you, or your, you know, other ancestors or people you have, you know, how does, I mean, that just feels like a whole different way of living to feel
to
like
be
there's
honest,
localized
you know,
spirits.
I don't really think about that for myself, but I have often said the notion that the ancestors are at a particular place, you know, that's an Old Testament or Hebrew scripture idea, but it's also very common in indigenous peoples.
Yeah, absolutely.
I've got no problem with that. That makes a lot of sense to me, but I haven't really kind of applied that to myself. Like, do I think my father who died 15 years ago, is he interacting with me now? It's theoretically possible. I just haven't really thought much about that.
And it's, I would guess that interacting with these localized spirits is maybe not a big part of your,
it's not a big
system.
Part of my spirituality, but I do know some Christians for whom it is. You know, when I teach in Africa, they're talking a lot about the dreams they have with their ancestors, and they're trying to interpret those. That's a big part of their Christian spirituality.
Hmm. Wow. Okay.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. That's something to think about.
that's something.
And I guess where I come back to on a lot of this stuff, I'm real into science. And
good.
I come back to a lot of this stuff and I'm like, this all, I mean, it sounds great. Like that sounds, you know, but like, then you go down the path of like those, you know, those TV shows where they're like, we're going to go into this building. I think I heard something, you know, and then like they're dinging a bell and they're like, ah, you know, like, and it's all the sensationalist, like ghost hunter people.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, that's where it goes. If you like go down that path, like too far, like if you want to go scientifically, you're like looking for them. But as far as like science goes, we don't have evidence of anything like this, right?
Well, you're really going to think I'm a weirdo now.
Let's hear it.
I mean, I also don't like those shows. I think they're far-fetched. However, the most influential philosophers in America at the start of the 20th century all believed in parapsychology or panpsychism. And so they thought interacting with the dead was, I mean, you go to the people and look at the philosophers at Harvard from about 1890 to 1930, the majority had this kind of view, and many of them were philosophers of science. So I'm not saying that proves anything, but if you take into account near-death experiences, out-of-body experiences, and all the parapsychology literature, there's more evidence for this than I think most people think. Now, I'm not investing my life in this, so it's like it's not a huge priority for me. But I'm also not wanting to dismiss it quickly like some people would.
No, that's interesting. I mean, I would love this to be the way it is. I get, honestly, like one of the saddest things about deconstruction for me has been potentially there's nothing after this. And
you don't have to believe
that. It sounds like a horrific belief.
Yeah.
I enjoy life way too much to believe that.
Have you read any in the near-death experience literature? I mean, that stuff is
a little bit.
Yeah, it's pretty convincing to me. Not that it proves an afterlife. I'm not saying that.
But it is fascinating.
Yeah.
It's like you said, not something you should just dismiss.
No. If you're a true scientist, you can't dismiss empirical evidence. And there's lots of empirical evidence for out of near-death experiences, out-of-body experiences.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. That's fascinating. Now I know what I'm going to go on my internet rabbit hole tonight.
I love it.
I love it. Well, Thomas, I really appreciate this.
This has been a fascinating conversation on so many levels.
Yeah. We have to do it again. We'll have to do it again.
I'd love to.
Yeah. So thanks so much. And I'm just really thankful for the work that you're doing, talking about deconstruction, pushing back on some of these ideas, because I know our listeners, they just feel so unheard.
And misrepresented often.
Misrepresented. Yeah, exactly. So I love that there are, you know, scholars out there, like smart people with, you know, letters before their names that are doing this kind of stuff. Because I think for the just random person out there, they feel so helpless. They feel like, well, how am I going to compete with this, name out there who's pushing back and it's come from the Gospel Coalition. And so who am I and how? So I think it's helpful. That's why we do this show, because we want to give people those.
Re-equip them.
Yes.
To feel like they have responses to what people are saying out there.
Yeah. Yeah. And feel like there's academia is behind them here too. And there are smart people who actually think this stuff and who are like writing about this and doing research on this. It's not just like all the people out there that just they don't want to feel like God's that way. It hurts their feelings that God's that. So I think, it's wonderful. It's wonderful that you're doing this, and keep going. Thanks. And we'll have all the links to your books and your website in the show notes. So go check out Thomas. But thank you so much.
Thanks to you guys. I've really enjoyed this.